Welcome to Storywell, a podcast that shares my written work. My name is Joselito Cordero, and I'm excited to share my stories with you. Hi, thanks for tuning in. Today I'll be reading my short story, Crickets and Stars. I wrote this story in 1991. I was 20 years old, just graduated from high school and attending community college. I was taking a creative writing course taught by Lori Dusing. A little bit about Lori Dusing's background. Lori Dusing was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She earned a BA from Harper College, SUNY, Binghamton, then moved in 1965 to the Bay Area in California, where she has lived ever since. She has an MA in English Literature from UC Berkeley, an MFA in Poetry from Mills College, and a PhD in English Literature from UC Davis. She has been the recipient of an NEA grant in Poetry. And she's published some poetry books, so definitely check her out. I have her to thank because, aside from being a great teacher, I took a few literature courses from her as well. She was also one of the teachers who wrote me a recommendation when I submitted my application to transfer from community college to UC Berkeley. So I have her to thank for that. So I'm going to begin reading my short story, Crickets and Stars. The alarm rings and I get up. It is 7:45 a.m. The room is dark because the blinds are closed. I slip out of bed, opening them. Outside, the world is gray. It had rained last night, and the street was the color purple. The alarm continues to ring. I leave it alone. Its noise is not meant for me. She stirs. I hear the bed creak with her awakening. She moans. Her arm stretches out, the hand groping for the snooze button. Instead, she knocks it over to the floor. Its sound continues. Oh man, shut up. Shut up, she says, turning over and burying her head in the pillow. I take the alarm and put it back on the drawer, turning it off. She sits up, watching me put on my jeans. Carrie's eyes look worn and her long hair disheveled. Jog with me, she says. Can't. Marlene's waiting, I say. She's quiet for a time, staring at something on the floor. What time are you visiting her? She asks. Noon, I answer. I go to the side of the bed and find my shoes. I sit on the bed, slipping them on. Carrie wraps her arms around my waist, her chin resting on my shoulder. Where are you both going? She asks. She kisses the back of my neck. I could smell her perfume. Reminds me of a brisk spring in a sunlit garden. Marlene doesn't know. Of course she doesn't know. She doesn't wear perfume. I turn to look at her, the blanket generously covering her intimate upper body regions. At the end of the bed, her clothes are messily piled. I take the clothes and put it down in front of her. Get dressed. We'll have breakfast, I say. Can I go with you two? She asks. Why? You want to sit at ringside? Don't be mad, she says, wrapping her arms over my shoulders. I hear her contented sigh. I turn around and gently cradle her form onto the bed. We kiss, and I feel myself plunge deep into her perfume. In my mind, I remember last night. The warmth of her caressing arms in mine excites me. My lips leave hers, and I'm kissing her face, her arms, and the beautiful curve of her neck. It's some time before it's over. With me buttoning my shirt and her sitting in front of her desk mirror fixing her hair, she's brushing the knotted ends. Carrie's hair is brown, so straight, simple, and brown. Are you going to tell her? She asks in a sudden offhand way. I don't know, I say, putting a hand through my hair. So much shit to think about. Of course, she says in monotone. She stops brushing. What? Why are you looking at me like that? She asks defensively. What are you doing? She shrugs and her eyes glaring at me through the mirror. I'm not doing anything, she says. Do you think it's that easy? That I could just tell her as soon as she sees me? She's quiet now, her movements and brushing more jerky and deliberate. Her head flinches as she encounters a snag. Damn this shit anyways, she says, throwing the brush down on the dresser. We say nothing for a while. We cannot move either. Then I approach and kiss the top of her head. Her hair is soft and downy on my lips. I'm sorry. Come on, I'll jog with you, I say. She takes one of my hands and places it on her cheek, holding it there gently. I'm not mad, she says. Let's jog. The morning is chilly. Carrie is on the porch steps making the final adjustments on her running shoes. Start stretching. It'll get you warm, she says. I have my hands wrapped inside my shirt. We're high on Piedmont Avenue, across from International House. We had walked from her apartment 5 minutes away to warm up. I heard the Sadler Tower bong. 8 o'clock here now in Berkeley. She's doing her stretches now, bent down with her fingers reaching for her toes. I could feel the wind blowing the damp air around me. There's a thick, musty smell, that same smell that follows after a heavy rain. You have to move around or you'll always be cold, she says, reaching for her toes. This isn't an everyday routine, is it? I ask. She gives me that engaging look of hers. Hun, I wouldn't be doing it otherwise, she says. The initial 10 minutes of jogging were awkward. My legs felt stiff, and the cold air was freezing my fingers and ears. Our jog consisted of starting from International House, going down Bancroft, turning into and through Sather Gate, turning at Dwinnell Hall, and heading down past the Valley Life Sciences building under construction, cutting through the forest area to Westgate and back to where we began. It was during about the fifth trip back to IHouse when I began to feel pain. I was gasping rapidly, and with each inhale of precious breath came outshoots of pain through my chest. Carrie must have noticed my struggle because my pace had slowed considerably. She stopped. We were in front of Dwinnell Hall. It was about 8:30. Here and there the students passed. I was hurting. I limped to one of the many wooden benches across the steps of Dwinnell. Carrie sat beside me, leaning on my shoulder. I thought about Marlene, about how I met her senior year high school, at the Halloween dance, dressed as Lelio. She was infatuated with George Sand then, and her short story, The Marquis, was one of Marlene's favorites. In her majestic costume, her hair tight and in a ponytail, looking like a young boy, but too beautiful to be a boy. I thought she had tried to dress as some early American colonial. In the chaos of strobe and blaring music, I approached. She was immaculate, my sweet Viola, gliding alone with ease and contentment among the menagerie of masks and costumes, illusions and magic. Do you want to dance? I began. One of the flashing lights caught her face for a moment, and I saw beyond illusions. I saw the young woman who would soon bless the next 2 years of my life. The tomboy who wore my plaid shirts with the sleeves too long and going past her hands. Yes, Marlene said. The lights dimmed further with the slow dance. I closed my eyes and let the darkness and warmth of her surround me. It was there, it was real, and I was inside of it, too confused, overjoyed, afraid, and nervous to remember anything beyond that moment. And I don't know what happened next, only that I spent the next few months wondering who I fell in love with. We had our moments of intimacy, but I don't think Marlene ever needed me desperately. And that made it more lonely and frustrating for me, wanting her to need me as much as I needed her. And our separation of different schools we went to made my void of loneliness greater. Out of sight is out of mind. I had met Carrie one day in Cafe Milano when I didn't want to be lonely anymore. Over chocolate cream pie and tea, I became a part of Carrie's life. Two people who truly need each other to fill our soul's emptiness. "Let's eat," Carrie says. She wakes me from my thoughts. Then Marlene's face disappears, and I find it difficult to remember how she looks like. Carrie and I walk, hand in hand. It was 12:30 when I arrived at Marlene's. She lived in Pond, an isolated area of hills and ranch-style homes. It was a 40-minute drive north of Berkeley. Each home had a considerable size of land to it, and the distance between each house was about 20 minutes away. Marlene's home was 3 stories. It was small compared to the other homes in its immediate area, but to the standards I was accustomed to, very large. It had a spacious Victorian look with rows of peach trees along either side of the wide walkway. At the center of the yard, a circular fountain with statues of dolphins, Poseidon, and a bull carrying off Europa on his back, sprayed water in a white foam. Anthony. Maganda hapon. It was Marlene's father, a handsome man with rugged features, with a face which illuminated a fierce, proud Filipino bearing. In his presence, I knew I was only a child. "Maganda hapon ho," I answered him. He took me inside. Inside, he let me take a seat on the cream couch in the family room. The first time I had been in her house, I had been overwhelmed. The house had high ceilings and a shimmering marble floor which reflected the golden light that streamed past the open sunroof. Marlene was an only child, born into a family who owned a resort in Philippines, Hawaii, and Florida. Their holidays were rarely spent at home, but when they were, there was always a towering tree teamed with the soft glow of ornaments during Christmas. Below the tree were an assorted rainbow of wrapped boxes waiting in anticipation to be opened. I had been invited to 2 of their holiday celebrations. A fire in the chimney, the sound of cheerful barking from the purebred golden spaniel, and the father, mother, and daughter in contented intimacy. They were beautiful people. Marlene had inherited her father's strength and her mother's beautiful, noble face. They were beyond my pedestrian ways. I heard footsteps from the stairs. I turned to see her mother come down. Her face looked haggard, but she was still breathtaking. She gave me a gentle smile, her eyes crinkling in the alluring way which I frequently saw in her daughter Marlene's happy moments. They were so alike, graceful and ageless. I imagine Marlene, years later, grown into the full blossom that her mother is now, and I think that it would be the biggest mistake of my life to ever lose her. There was one New Year when I, drunk and delirious, took her mother on a walk along their expansive garden behind their house. It was chilly, with the cold fuming white from our mouths. The inky night was saturated with stars, and the crickets played their insect violins for all upon the year. We stood beneath the cascading branches of their willow tree, fed by a tiny stream of water from a nearby pond. We held hands tight because we were too drunk to give a damn. I could not take my eyes away from her face. In my condition, I only saw blurry images, with her face prominent like some sacred vision in a dream. She laughed in that hoarse, silky way Marlene laughed. "You're in love with me, aren't you?" she asked. Her face was flushed pink in the winter night. I thought about how much I wanted to melt into her, how I yearned to hold her into that night, wishing that time would stop forever to stay cold, winter, and star-filled. "I'm in love with your daughter," I said. She took one of my hands and kissed my palm. Her eyes were fixed to mine. "They're all asleep. Don't be afraid," she whispered. close your eyes, I said, and she did. My hands, trembling, took her head gently, bringing her face close. I could hear her breath, its scent of chocolate and wine, pouring into me, and I kissed the soft skin of her eyelid. She laughed and kissed my left earlobe. "You're a sweet young man," she said. Then with a final smile of understanding, she left me, going back to the warmth of the house. The following morning, when I went down from my room for breakfast, we saw each other in the kitchen. Nothing needed to be said, and from this day, there was no need for it. "Kumusta, Anthony?" "Marlene's waiting in the garden," she says, not unkindly. When she saw her husband, I noticed a tightness in her jaw. I saw Marlene's father glare back at her, and I wondered if I came at a bad time. I nodded in polite reply and went out to the garden. I heard the bark of the spaniel and followed it. I saw Marlene sitting on the cement bench in front of a row of rose bushes. She was bent over, fondly petting the dog. The dog saw me and broke from her, sprinting for me. Its tail in joyful wag, it stood on its hind legs and leaned on the front of my legs, its tongue in happy affection. I petted him and looked at Marlene. Marlene gave me a weak smile. She wore dark glasses. "What took you so long?" she asked tonelessly. "I got caught in traffic." She turned from me and looked down at the brick walkway. Her arms were crossed. "Oh," she said. I took a seat beside her. She leaned her head on my shoulder and put a hand on my knee. "I missed you," she whispered. I put my arm over her shoulder and brought her closer. "Missed you too," I said. She said nothing. Then I felt her tighten up. She was breathing with a strained effort, and it was then that I noticed she was crying. This was weird. I looked at her. "Marl, what happened? What's wrong?" I asked. And she pushed me away. She crossed her arms again and she turned her face from me. "Nothing, just some stupid shit. Look, I'm sorry, Anthony. I'm not much for lunch to get today. Can you just call me later?" I looked at her. Her face was wet from tears. "Are you sure? We don't have to eat. We'll just talk," I said. She nodded vehemently. "No," she says in a strained sob. "Just go, please, and don't go through the house. Go to the side door." I got up to the door. I got up to go. I felt tight all over. When I turned one last time to look at her, I saw that the dog had pounced on the bench beside her. It was looking at her in perplexed curiosity. Her arms were still crossed and her head remained low, looking at the brick walkway with a stunned silence. The rest of the day I spent with Carrie. We had lunch at Blondie's Pizza and watched Madame Butterfly. I couldn't concentrate on the movie. My mind was on Marlene. I wondered if she knew. I asked Carrie's opinion on it. I kept asking her during the movie. She never replied. It was finally at the end of the movie and in my car that she gave me an answer. "I don't care or give a damn on what she thinks." She put a finger to her temples, rubbing it. "Anthony, don't bullshit with me. Go back to her if you want, but don't drag me into this. I don't want to be confused and hurt by you. Just tell me now, do you want her?" "Anthony, look at me. Do you?" "Of course not. But I'm not a heartless monster," I blurted. "I don't know what to do with... I don't know what to do, Carrie. Can't you see that?" The car screeched when I backed it out of its parking place. The engine roared and I almost hit a car when I switched lanes. There was a loud blaring honk. I sighed. "I don't know what to do." Carrie was quiet. Then, "Just take me home," she said. Do you want me to call you later? I asked. I wanted to say sorry. Sorry for everything. Sorry that I was weak and just a boy in a cold universe. It took a while before she answered. You do what you want to do. And her tone made me feel worse than ever. At 9:30, I called Marlene. There were four rings before I heard her mother's voice. Hello? May I speak to Marlene? There was a pause. Anthony, is that you? Yes, I'm sorry. Did I call at a bad time? Were you all sleeping? No, but Marlene's not here. Isn't she with you? My head was whirling. No, she's not. There was another pause, followed by her mom's sigh of sudden revelation. Oh, well, maybe she took a drive. She does that, you know, especially during the winter. Do you know where she could have gone? I really couldn't tell you, she replied with genuine honesty. She doesn't tell me anything. She can be annoyingly private sometimes, especially these days. She paused, then, dear, how are you two getting along? Fine, I said. Everything's just the same as it always was. Her voice was low. That's good. Because it would be very bad if she was hurt by someone. It would be cruel and malicious. She's too naive to go through something like this. Do you see what I'm saying? And the suddenness and abrupt hint of anger and threat in her voice shocked me. It was then that brutal reality slapped me hard in the face. I was a poor, struggling student whose family was just getting by with their dollar bills spent in lotto tickets, praying to God that those numbers they picked would take them to the promised land. Marlene's mother and father were wealthy and generous, but knew exactly where I was from, how they felt about their princess involved with middle-class mediocrity, I didn't know. I thought about New Year's and wondered bitterly if Marlene's mother had just been testing me, trying to see if my lowly economic status was also a reflection of lowly moral values. I couldn't say anything. Her voice resumed its casual chumminess. Well, when she gets home, I'll tell her you called. You will be awake later tonight, won't you? She asked in a commanding way. Yes. Yes, I will. Good. Well, good night. She hung up before I could reply. In my mind, I tried to imagine where Marlene could have gone. Where could she have driven in Pawn at this hour? The phone rang. It must be Carrie, trying to apologize to me. Hello? Maybe she understands now. Maybe. Anthony, I need you. It was Marlene. Marlene? Honey, where are you? I called your house and... I'm at Pacifica, the beach. I'll wait for you, she says, hanging up. It took me a few moments before I could move, with the dial tone murmuring flatly in my ear. I wondered, did she know? Did she know? It was 10:15 when I got to Pacifica. Pacifica is a tiny oceanside town near Daly City. Its beach was located just behind the town's only shopping plaza. There was a small side street with apartments which overlooked the beach. There were steps from the top that led down to the beach. A gazebo had been built for the public to gaze down at the view. I saw Marlene's car parked along by the sidewalk. I parked behind her. She was inside the gazebo with her hands clutching tight. She was inside the car with her hands clutching the steering wheel tight. I got out of my car. I approached. Her eyes were looking straight ahead. I tapped on her window. She opened it without looking at me. You up to driving? She asked. Where are we go? She turned to me, her face in annoyed fury. Are you going to help me or not? Okay, let's go, I said. I went inside my car and waited. I saw Marlene come, wearing one of my white sweaters with her blue jeans. In her hand, she carried her purse. She walked stiffly, as if with indecision. As soon as she was inside and had her door closed, she said, "Drive. I'll tell you where to go." And we drove to Pacifica's narrow streets. I drove for about 5 minutes, making rights and lefts, until finally, "There, park across the street from that house," she says in a whisper. The house was small and old with the lights on inside. It was a two-story, and we saw a figure in the window of the bedroom. I could hear Marlene's breathing, the same strange sound I heard earlier today in her garden. Marlene turned to me. Her face in the dim glow of the moon looked searching and desperate. "Anthony, I love you." "Marlene," I implored, "what's the matter?" I saw her hand shaking, reaching for her purse under the seat. Her breathing was louder now and sounded terrified. "Oh God, I don't want to do this. Please God, don't make me do this. Oh God," she murmured. Her fingers undid the clasp of the purse and opened it. "Marlene, stop. What are you doing? Please. I'm here. Tell me." I saw her slowly take something out of her purse. "What's?" In the moon's harsh light, it glinted. "Wrong?" And I felt my own breath scrape from my lungs. Her hand was shaking, carefully dropping it on her lap. A .38 revolver. "Marl?" She was looking at me, her face tortured in pain. "I can't do it alone, Anthony. You have to help me. That's what love is, isn't it? Devotion and support. I'm not strong enough." She was holding the gun tight in both hands and had it resting on her chest. I saw her eyes turn to the house. I could tell from the form that the person behind the curtain was a woman. Marlene looked at me. "Ring the doorbell. I'll be right behind you." "Marl, what?" She turned to me savagely. "Just do it. Don't ask me anything because I don't want to tell you the answers. Can't you just help me do this one thing? I'm not asking you to pull the trigger. That's my job." "Marlene, this is crazy. Why are you doing this? What's this person done?" But she doesn't answer. Instead, she opens her door and walks with purposeful strides to the house. I follow, feeling my heart pound in my chest. I grab her from behind, terrified that she'd turn and accidentally shoot me. My voice felt hot and dry. "I'll help you," I said. I saw her face, her eyes closed tight with momentary relief. "Thank you," she whispered. I approached the door, slowly, my mind racing. There was still a chance for me to act. When she answers the door, I'll push her into the house, onto the floor. Marlene will act, hopefully falling back from the shot's recoil. If I'm lucky, she'll totally miss, or she'll just hit me on the leg instead. If I'm lucky. Yes. It was a middle-aged Filipino woman. She had a homely, matronly quality about her. "Run! Run and hide," I screamed in my head. I couldn't say it. I could feel the back of my neck get stiff and hot. "Close the door. She's got a gun," I thought. "May I help you?" she asked. I couldn't move. I remembered the .38, how blunt and large it was. I didn't want to die. "Run. I can't help you. I'm too afraid to die. I'm a boy, not a man. Run, run." The woman was looking at me impatiently. "What do you want?" "Get it over with, Marlene," I thought. "I don't give a damn. Just pull the trigger." I don't know how I managed to turn around, but I did. And Marlene wasn't there. I looked back at the woman and smiled weakly. "Sorry, wrong house," I said. The woman rolled her eyes and closed the door. I walked back to my car and saw Marlene sitting on the curb in front of the car, her head buried in her arms. I sat beside her. She was crying. In one hand, she loosely held a 38. "I'm a coward," she sobbed. "Because you couldn't kill somebody? That makes you a coward?" She looked at me, her head quivering from her intense crying. "I'm a coward because I just let it happen. I'm a coward because I relied on faith in God." I felt awkward. "You're not a coward," I said. She got to her feet quickly. "Yes, I am," she said. She was looking at me, both arms limp at her sides. I was so stupid. All my life, I've been living in a fairy tale, living like some disillusioned fool believing in love, eternity, and enchanted castles. Marlene looked up at the evening sky. I thought he was God. I thought he'd always be there. She's not even that pretty. How could he do this to us? How could he betray us and take away the only magic we had as a family? Then I understood, only too well, and I thought of Carrie and realized what a greedy, foolish monster I was. She sat down, looking at the ground. "My mom doesn't even know. She still believes in her illusions. How am I going to tell her? How am I going to tell her that Dad is weak? How am I going to tell her that he doesn't love her in the same way anymore?" There was nothing I could say. Marlene placed her hands in mine, looking at me with intensity. "Anthony, don't ever leave me. I don't ever want our enchantment to be broken." "I love you, Marlene. Don't ever doubt that," I said, and we held each other tight. All around me, I heard the crickets play their insect violins. Above us, the stars shined fiercely. It was 1:15. I had rung her bell 4 times before she answered the door. It was Carrie, her eyes sleepy and blinking. "Anthony?" she asked, the hall light flooding behind her. "We have to talk," I said, and I thought about the coldness of the winter and how I may never see spring again. The end. Thanks for listening.